You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of The World of the Senses and the World of the Spirit by Rudolf Steiner. It's Collected Works, Volume 134, given in Hanover from the 27th of December to the 1st of January, 1912. In this cycle of lectures, it will be my task to build a bridge between more or less everyday things, between experiences we might encounter in ordinary life and the most lofty affairs of humanity. This may show us one of those paths which lead on from our everyday life toward what anthroposophy, or spiritual science, can mean for our soul and spirit. We know, if we enter ever more deeply into what it is able to give us, that anthroposophy will flow into our feelings, into our will, and into the powers we need in order to come to grips with the many and varied events of life. And we also know, through the way we can experience the influences which are just now approaching us from the higher worlds, that anthroposophy is in some measure needed by today's humanity. We know that within a relatively brief period of time, humanity would lose all certainty, all confidence, all inner quietness, all the tranquility we need for life, if the revelations we describe as anthroposophy were unable to reach humanity in our present age. We also know that through this spiritual stream of anthroposophy, two tendencies of people's thinking and feeling are approaching one another with some violence. One of these is the tendency of thinking and feeling which has been in preparation for many centuries and has already taken hold of humanity everywhere in the widest circles, or will most certainly do so very soon. This is what we term the materialistic tendency of thinking and feeling. It is materialistic in the widest sense. And it is, as it were, clashing violently with the other way of thinking, the way which comes through anthroposophy and is the spiritual tendency. The conflict of these two tendencies, of these two ways of thinking and feeling, will become ever more noticeable in the near future. In the way it manifests, we shall not always know whether we are dealing with a tendency of thinking and feeling which is undisguised in its materialistic presentation, or which is perhaps another tendency hiding behind some mask or other. This is because there will be plenty of materialistic tendencies which will disguise themselves as something spiritual, and it will sometimes be difficult to see where materialism is hiding and where a spiritual tendency is truly to be found. In two lectures I gave recently, I endeavored to demonstrate in various ways how difficult it is to make the necessary distinction in this regard. In the first instance, I tried to give a sense of how certain thoughts and ideas, which can easily dominate us at the present time, can make of us perfectly honest and upright opponents of spiritual science. Quote, how to refute spiritual science, close quote, is what I tried to demonstrate in the first of those lectures, which was then followed by another, describing, quote, how to defend spiritual science, close quote, or how to substantiate spiritual science. It was not my intention in those lectures to demonstrate everything possible in either direction. My purpose was to provide a sense of how numerous, exceedingly plausible ways can be found by means of which the worldview of spiritual science can be refuted. Nevertheless, those who cannot help but pour forth such antagonism from their soul should certainly not, in every case, be counted nowadays among the most dishonest individuals, for they are often, in fact, the most honest among those wrestling to find the truth. I shall not here present you once again with all the reasons which can be stated in opposition to spiritual science. But I must point out that today's habits of thought and ways of looking at the world do provide very well-founded reasons on the basis of which spiritual science can be thoroughly refuted. If we wish to refute spiritual science, if we want to seek out all possible reasons that can be set against spiritual science, we must ask the question, how can we reach the most thorough, the most fundamental refutation? You see, a person may acknowledge spiritual science from the very bottom of his soul. And yet, if he then also familiarizes himself with the essentially materialistic ideas put forward by the sciences, he will find it perfectly possible to refute spiritual science very thoroughly. To do this, he must first bring about within himself a certain state of soul. This state of soul in a person who wishes to refute spiritual science involves adopting a completely and utterly intellectualistic point of view. What is meant by this will become clear when we view the matter from the opposite standpoint. Once we have grasped what I have here presented as my own personal experience, if we are familiar with the results of today's science, while relying solely on our intellect, we shall find it possible to refute spiritual science very thoroughly. But now, let us pause while we endeavor to approach our task from an entirely different angle. You see, we human beings are able to view the world from two sides. One view arises when we, let's say, witness a beautiful sunrise, where the sun emerges from the golden red morning sky, as though giving birth to itself, and then spreads its brilliance across the earth, while we immerse ourselves in the thought of how the sun's warmth magically brings forth life from the earth's depths in the ever-recurring round of the seasons. Or, when we observe the going down of the sun as the red sky at night grows dim until total blackness holds sway, in which myriads of stars shine out. Then we can become absorbed in the wonders of the starry sky at night. This view of nature all around us can fill us with the most profound delight. Such a perception resembles one of Goethe's fundamental ideas. He once expressed it so beautifully. As we look up to the wonders of the starry heavens and watch the circulation of the universe in all its glory, then surely we have a sense of how all these marvels surrounding us in creation only grow meaningful when they are mirrored in the astounded soul of a human being. We do indeed play with the idea that just as the air around us forms our being, just as it enters into us when we breathe, and through the process it undergoes within us, then builds us up, that just as we are an outcome of this air and its laws and its composition, so are we in some way an outcome of the whole wide world which surrounds us with all that flows into us through our senses, not only in what we see, but also in what we take in through the world of sound and all the other worlds flowing into us through our senses. The fact that we stand there before the external world of the senses and are an outcome of all those senses flowing together, and are able to tell ourselves that we have within us everything we perceive around us through all our senses, this fact enables us to understand that the meaning of all this is best fulfilled through the crystallizing out of the marvel which is the human being. How truly are we then overcome by the notion expressed with such primeval passion by the Greek poet, quote, "Of all that is mighty in the world, the most mighty is the human being," close quote. How one-sided do each of the world's external phenomena appear to us? Yet in the human being, all these phenomena seem to merge together into a oneness when we view the world of the senses outside ourselves, and then see the human being in its midst as a sensual being into which all else is flowing. The more closely we investigate the world, the more does the human being emerge before us as a confluence of all the one-sided phenomena of the universe. A thought enters into our soul when we cultivate within ourselves this feeling of the great wide world and the way it unites to flow into the human being. A thought filled with profoundly inspiring feelings. The concept of the divinely intended human being who emerges as though the deeds of gods and godly purposes had built up an entire universe whence they everywhere caused influences to flow, which in the end combined in the most estimable of works then placed by those gods into the universe, namely the human being, an opus of the divine will. This is how it was expressed by one who was contemplating the world of the senses with regard to the human being. In relation to the miracle of the human ear, all of us are the music maker's instruments, as are we also in relation to that other musical instrument, the miracle of the human larynx. We can marvel at much that is in the world. Not to marvel at the human being who stands there in its midst is possible only if we are unfamiliar with the wonders of his configuration. But when in soul we immerse ourselves in such contemplations, then the thought arises, how great are the deeds of those divine spiritual beings who have brought this human being into existence? This is one angle to be gained from a worldview. But there is also another angle. The other angle is revealed to us when we develop a sense for the grandeur and potency of what we term moral ideals. When we look into our own soul and are struck by the significance of moral ideals for the world. A many-sided, healthy human nature is called for if we are to sense fully how sublime are the moral ideals of humanity. In contemplating these moral ideals, we can develop in ourselves something which may work within our soul just as powerfully as the wonders and revelations of the universe work on us from the outside. This comes about when we kindle all possible love and enthusiasm in relation to the moral ideals and aims of humanity. It may fill us with immeasurable warmth. And then this sense of the moral ideals is joined as of necessity by the idea of the aforementioned worldview related to the revelation of the universe through the human being. Those who have the strongest sense of the might of those moral ideals will also be most powerfully affected by that other thought and say, O man, as you stand here today, how distant are you from the lofty moral ideals which can blossom within your heart? How small are you in all your capabilities over against the greatness of the moral ideals which you might set yourself? Only when our soul begins to grow can we assess its inadequacy over against those moral ideals. And the thought then dawns in our soul, which helps us endeavor with courage and conviction to make the moral ideals a little more strong within us than they were before. Or else it can happen in some temperaments that the sense of inadequacy of the moral ideals begins to take root in the soul, which then feels utterly shattered and alienated from the gods, for the very reason that it does in fact have a strong understanding of the divinely willed aspect of the external human being's place in the world of the senses. Here I stand, such individuals might say to themselves, with everything I possess externally. Regarding yourself from the outside, you cannot help saying, yes, I am a confluence of the whole divinely created world. I am a being desired by the gods, with a countenance resembling the divine. But then you look into yourself, and there you see the ideals which the gods have inscribed into your heart, and which are intended by them to be powers you can use. So then you feel the experience of your inadequacy gushing forth from your soul. We have within us these two possibilities for looking at the world. Either we can regard ourselves from outside and be profoundly glad about our divinely desired nature, or we can regard ourselves from within and be profoundly disappointed about our soul in its estrangement from the divine. With a sound sense of the situation, we are bound to say, the forces which have brought forth the human being like a mighty extract of the whole universe are the very same forces which have also brought forth the moral ideals that are inscribed into our hearts. Why is the one so very different from the other? This surely is the great riddle of human existence. In truth, neither anthroposophy nor philosophy would ever have come about in the world if the dichotomy just described had not arisen in human souls, either more consciously in the realm of thinking or less consciously in the realm of feeling. The experience of it is the source of all human questioning and investigation. What has come between the divinely willed human being and the human being who is estranged from the divine? This is the most fundamental question of all philosophy. However varied the formulations and characterizations of this question may have become, nevertheless it underlies all human thinking and all human pondering. How may we gain an idea of how to build a bridge between the indubitably inspiring view of the external human being and the undoubtedly conflicting view of the soul leading to so much doubt? The path that must be trodden by the human soul in order to rise up in a right and dignified manner to the highest questions of existence will have to be described in more detail. This will then tell us where the errors originate. In the world outside, insofar as it is dominated by external science, people will always say, yes, indeed, knowledge and truth will be the result if one has made the correct judgments. In order to characterize the fundamental error inherent in this presumption that knowledge and truth will arise out of correct judgments, I recently employed a very simple comparison, which I would now like to repeat here to show you that what is right does not necessarily lead to what is real. There was once a small village boy whose parents always sent him to buy fresh rolls. They would give him 10 pennies, and he would return with 6 rolls. One roll cost 2 pennies, and for 10 pennies the boy returned with 6 rolls. The little lad was not much good at sums, so he didn't bother to work out why he always brought 6 rolls home with him, even though one roll cost 2 pennies. But then a kind of foster brother came to live with the family. He was more or less the same age, but better at arithmetic. He noticed that the lad was given 10 pennies for the baker, and he also knew that 1 roll cost 2 pennies. So he said, "You should bring 5 rolls home with you." He was good at arithmetic and thought quite rightly that if 1 roll cost 2 pennies, then 10 pennies would buy 5 rolls. And yet the lad came home with 6. So the boy, who was good at sums, said, "It's not right. If 1 roll costs 2 pennies and you are sent to the baker with 10 pennies, then since 2 goes into 10 5 times, you can't possibly come back with 6 rolls. Someone must have made a mistake, or else you pinched a roll." And yet, next morning, the boy again returned home with 6 rolls for 10 pennies. This was because in that village it was the custom that someone buying 5 rolls for 10 pennies was always given 6. It was a very agreeable custom for the people, who needed only 5 rolls for their household. Well, the boy who was good at sums was quite right. There was no mistake in his thinking. And yet his correct thinking did not agree with the reality. We have to admit that his correct thinking did not conform to reality, for the very reason that reality does not always comply with correct thinking. You see, as in this instance, however conscientious and intricate the thought may be, which leads to however logical and correct a conclusion, the result, when measured against reality, can be completely and utterly wrong. This is always possible. Therefore, a proof gained by means of thinking will never, but never, accord in any way with reality. It is also possible to be mistaken in other ways, with regard to the peculiar interrelationship of cause and effect, when applied to the outside world. I will give you an example of this too. Imagine a person walking along beside a large stream. Watching him from a distance, you see him suddenly fall over the edge into the water and rush to save him, but when you pull him out, he is dead. So now you have a corpse. Perhaps, mustering all your ability to think logically, you will reason that he has drowned. Maybe there was a stone at the spot where it happened, so he stumbled over it, fell into the water, and drowned. The sequence of thoughts is perfectly correct. Someone walks along a river bank, stumbles over a stone, falls into the water, and is dead when he is pulled out. So he has drowned. This is the only explanation. But with this particular individual, it may not be the explanation. If we don't allow ourselves to be ruled by the links between cause and effect, we may discover that at the moment when he fell into the river, the man had a heart attack which caused him to fall into the water. He was already dead when he fell, and only seemed to react in the way one normally reacts when falling into water alive. So you see that in this case, it is wrong to string together the external events of stumbling, falling into the water, and drowning. It does not conform to reality, because the individual fell into the water on account of being dead, and was not pulled out dead on account of having fallen. Judgments as wrong as this one about causes and effects, and much more subtle ones as well, are made all over the place in our scientific literature. But they remain unnoticed, just as would have been the case if we had not investigated the matter of the man with the heart attack. All I am suggesting is that, in fact, with regard to reality, our thinking is utterly incompetent. It is inconclusive and no judge of what is actually true. So how are we to extricate ourselves from the morass of doubt and not knowing if we can indeed not rely on our thinking being a reliable guide? When one has had experience in such matters and has concerned oneself a great deal with thinking as such, then one knows that it is possible to prove anything and contradict anything, so one is no longer impressed by the astuteness of philosophy. One can admire astuteness, but to rely on conclusions arrived at on the basis of the reasoning faculty alone is not possible, because one knows that equally cogent conclusions, proving the opposite, can also be arrived at through reasoning. This is true of all things, which can be either proven or refuted. Very interesting observations, especially those based on real life, can often be made in relation to this. There is a certain allure, although only a theoretical allure, in making the acquaintance of people who have reached a specific point in their soul development, namely the point where they sense and experience inwardly that everything can be proven or refuted, but who have not yet acquired what one might term a spiritual worldview. In recent weeks I have often been occupied with such thoughts in remembrance of a man I once met who possessed, to a most remarkable degree, a constellation of soul of this kind, and who was thus unable to press on to a true comprehension of reality through spiritual knowledge. What he had attained was the realization that, basically, every philosophical statement could be either denied or confirmed. He was a professor at the University of Vienna, a highly intelligent man who died a few weeks ago, Lawrence Müller. This highly intelligent man was able to put forward with the utmost clarity every possible proof for all manner of philosophical systems and ideas, or, equally, to contradict every argument. He always described himself as a skeptic. I once heard him make what is in some ways a rather terrible statement. Well, all philosophy is, in the end, no more than a very beautiful way of playing with ideas. Having often watched the sparkling intelligence of Milner's play with ideas, I found it most interesting to observe how he could never be pinned down on any particular point, since he had never admitted anything specific. When someone else expressed disagreement with some worldview or other, he would then lovingly put forward every possible argument in favor of that worldview, even though, perhaps a few days earlier, he had himself ingeniously condemned it down to the ground. He was an exceedingly interesting thinker, in fact, in a sense, even one of the most important philosophers of our age. And why he was basically like this is also interesting. Apart from having a thorough knowledge about the philosophical progress of humanity, he was also a Catholic priest, and essentially he always wanted to remain a good Catholic priest, even though latterly he was a professor at the University of Vienna. The way in which he immersed himself in the Catholic way of thinking brought it about in some measure that the religious fervor of his immersion in certain trains of thought made everything else in the world appear to him to be a mere playing with ideas. Yet it was his Catholic way of thinking which prevented him from extricating himself from his doubts. He was too great to remain within the merely dogmatic aspect of Catholicism, and yet the Catholicism was too strong within him to allow him to rise to a truly spiritual way of scientifically comprehending reality. It is most interesting to observe a soul like this, a soul that has come to the point where one can study what would be needed to enable such an individual to arrive at reality. For, of course, this exceedingly perspicacious man was quite aware that he was not capable of grasping reality. Even in ancient Greece, it was possible to state what the point of departure would be for a healthy way of thinking which wants to reach reality. And that statement, already put forward in ancient Greece, is surely still valid today. Namely, that all study undertaken by human beings must come about on the basis of amazement. Let us, my dear friends, look at this in a positive light. Let us regard as something positive the fact that a soul striving to reach the truth must have within it the condition of being amazed when confronted with the universe. In fully comprehending the power of that Greek statement, we are able to say, regardless of the other reasons leading a person to search and ponder, when his point of departure is amazement about the realities of the world, then it will be akin to sowing a seed in the ground out of which a plant then grows. In a certain sense, all knowledge must grow out of the seed of amazement. The matter is different when someone does not have amazement as his point of departure, but rather, perhaps, some sort of principles hammered into him in his youth by well-meaning teachers. Principles which have made a philosopher of him. Or when the circumstances of his upbringing meant that it was customary to enter into a philosophical way of thinking under the influence of prevailing attitudes. It is also well known that the final examinations in philosophy are the easiest of all. In short, there are hundreds and thousands of paths which lead to philosophy without involving amazement. All such points of departure lead to a way of living with the truth, which resembles making a plant out of papier-mâché instead of growing one from seed. This is an entirely valid comparison, because all true knowledge, with any prospect of comprehending the riddles of the universe, must grow out of the seed of amazement. However sagacious a thinker might be, even one who suffers from a kind of exuberance of sagacity, will get nowhere if he has never passed through the stage of amazement. He will devise sagacious, clever concatenations of ideas, none of which will be incorrect. But that which is correct does not necessarily have to lead to reality. Before we begin to think, before we even set our thinking in motion, it is essential that we pass through the state of amazement. For a kind of thinking which progresses without the state of amazement will, after all, remain a mere playing with ideas. Thinking simply must originate from amazement. And this is not all. Even this is insufficient. Although thinking must originate in amazement, there may be a person who through his karma has a turn of mind which is quite sagacious. But if he develops this sagacity alone, then any initial amazement is no help. If, after some initial amazement, he proceeds to develop his thinking merely through thinking, he will be unable to progress to finding reality. Of course, I am not saying that a person must become thoughtless or that thinking is harmful. This is a view which is rather prevalent even in theosophical circles, where thinking is regarded as bad and damaging, even by people who say that thinking must emanate from amazement. Once one has begun to think and is able to list the seven principles of the human being and so on, it is not necessary to cease thinking, for thinking must continue. But after amazement has set in, another state of soul must be achieved, and that is the state of reverence for that which is approached by thinking. After the state of amazement, the state of reverence, of awe, must be attained. And any thinking which emancipates itself from reverence, from an awed view of what is revealed by thinking, will be unable to penetrate through to reality. Thinking must never be permitted to trip light-footed around the world. Once it has moved beyond the state of amazement, it must become rooted in the feeling of reverence for the grounds of the universe. Here the path of knowledge becomes very much the antithesis of what we today speak of as science. For this is where we might say to a person standing with his test tubes in a laboratory, analyzing substances and synthesizing others, this is not the way to arrive at the truth. You can analyze and synthesize as much as you like, but the results are merely facts. You are approaching the facts of the world without respect, without reverence. You should stand before the reactions in your test tube with the respect and reverence of a priest before the altar. But what would be that person's reply nowadays? He would most probably laugh in your face, be full of derision, because from their point of view, modern-day scientists are quite unable to see any connection between reverence on the one hand and truth or knowledge on the other. If he did not laugh at you, he would at best concede. I am truly thrilled by what goes on in my test tubes, but you cannot convince a sensible individual that my enthusiasm is anything other than my own private affair and has nothing to do with the discovery of truth. This is the second stage. But even after attaining some degree of reverence, if a person continued to proceed as before merely with his thinking, he would again reach something unreal and be unable to make progress. His discoveries would be correct, and because he would have taken the first two steps, that correctness would be founded on certain firm principles. But he would, nevertheless, soon begin to feel uncertain once more. The reason for this is that it is necessary for a third stage to be reached in our soul. Having become sufficiently immersed in amazement and reverence, the third stage might be described as feeling oneself to be in wisdom-filled harmony with the laws of the universe. You see, feeling oneself to be in wisdom-filled harmony with the laws of the universe can only be attained once one has in some way fully understood how meaningless mere thinking is. One must tell oneself over and over again that a person who relies solely on the correctness of thinking, whether in confirming or denying something, is in the same situation as the small boy who quite correctly calculated the number of rolls. If he had been able to tell himself, "What I have worked out may very well be correct, but I must not rely on my correct thinking, but should instead search for the truth and enter into reality," then he would have discovered something higher than correctness, namely the village custom of adding a further roll when 5 are purchased. He would have discovered that one must turn away from oneself and enter fully into the world, and that correct thinking has no bearing on reality. However, it is not at all easy to enter into wisdom-filled harmony with reality. If it were easy, dear friends, then neither you nor anyone else would ever have experienced being seduced by Lucifer. For in truth, it was indeed the intention of the divine guides of the world that human beings should be endowed with the ability to distinguish between good and evil, to gain knowledge, to eat from the tree of knowledge. But this was to come about much later. The mistake human beings made was to want to attain such knowledge too soon, to want to distinguish between good and evil too soon. It was Lucifer's seduction which made them want what should only have come about later on. This is how such inadequate knowledge has come about, knowledge for which human beings should have been obliged to strive, and which is now like a premature birth by comparison with a child carried to full term. It was the Gnostics of old, and we can sense how right they were, who said that the knowledge accompanying human beings from one incarnation to the next is a premature birth, an ectroma. They used this very word, because humanity could not wait until whatever should have led to genuine knowledge had been properly experienced. In other words, periods of time should have been allowed to elapse, during which certain states of soul would have ripened within the human being, which would then have enabled true knowledge to arise. Humanity is still committing this original sin today. For if we were to refrain from committing it, we would be in less of a hurry to regard one fact or another as the truth, but would instead seek to gain in maturity in order to comprehend certain truths. Again, people today would be puzzled to be told, "You think you perfectly understand the theorem of Pythagoras, but if you really wanted to comprehend in all its mysterious significance the theorem that the square on the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides," or let us take a simpler example, "if you want to comprehend the fact that 3 times 3 equals 9, you will first need to have a variety of experiences in your soul." And a person today would be even more amused to be told, "You will only truly comprehend this when you have brought yourself into harmony with the laws of the universe, which have ordered things in such a way as to make the laws of mathematics appear to us as they do." People today are still committing the original sin when they believe that they can comprehend everything at every stage while paying no attention to the fact that they first need to have certain experiences in order to comprehend something. They must realize that they have to feel inwardly supported by the understanding that however many firm judgments they may make, they can achieve nothing in matters of reality. This belongs to the third stage, which I want to describe. However much effort we put into making a judgment, errors can always arise. A correct judgment only results if we have attained a certain degree of maturity, if we have waited until the judgment itself leaps toward us. It is not when we make the effort to reach a judgment, but when we make the effort to be ready for the judgment that it comes toward us, and then the judgment has something to do with reality. However much effort you devote to forming a correct judgment, you can never be sure that this inner effort will achieve a competent judgment. You can only hope to arrive at a correct judgment if you devote every care to becoming ever more and more mature, by, as it were, waiting for the correct judgments to come to you through the revelations which enter into you because you have become mature. One can have the most remarkable experiences in this way. A person who is quick and ready with a judgment will of course think, if someone has fallen into the water and been pulled out dead, he must have drowned. But a person who has grown wise and mature through the experiences in his life will know that in every individual case, a generalized judgment is meaningless. He will know that in every single instance he encounters, he must allow the judgment to arise out of the facts he sees played out before his eyes. Life itself can show how true this is. Suppose a person says something, but that you have a different opinion. You can point out that what he is saying is wrong. Your judgment can be entirely different from his. Indeed, what he says and what you say might both be wrong. Both judgments might be right, or both might be wrong. At this third stage, it will not be relevant to you that one person forms a judgment which differs from that of another. That is not what is relevant. A wise person will always hold back with his judgment in order not to become too involved with it. He will even hold back when he is aware that he might indeed be right. He will hold back as a kind of experiment, as though trying it out. Or if someone tells you something today and then in 2 months' time says the opposite, there is no need for you to get involved, since you have nothing whatever to do with the two facts. If you let the two facts work upon you, there is no need for you to make a contradiction, since the two make their own contradiction. Here, it is not you, but the world around you which forms the judgment, and it is only at this point that the wise person begins to judge. It is interesting to note that if one lacks the concept about wisdom, making judgments, one will never know, for instance, how Goethe carried out his scientific studies. That is why Goethe made the interesting statement, you will find it in my introduction to Goethe's scientific works, that one should never form judgments or hypotheses about external phenomena, because the phenomena themselves are the theories. They themselves give expression to their ideas, if one has made oneself mature enough to allow them to work upon one in the right way. It is not a matter of making an effort to squeeze out of one's soul what one considers to be correct. One must be prepared for the judgment to leap toward one out of the facts themselves. Our relationship with thinking must not be to make thinking the judge of things, but to allow it to be an instrument through which the things speak to us. That is what is meant by being in harmony with the things. Once we have come to grips with this third state, it is still not permissible for thinking to stand on its own feet, for we are now reaching what is, in a certain way, the loftiest state of soul to be attained if we want to reach the truth. This is the state which is well described by the word acquiescence, amazement, reverence, wisdom-filled harmony with the world's phenomena, acquiescence to the course of the world. These are the stages through which we have to pass, stages which must always run parallel with thinking, and which thinking must never be permitted to forsake. For otherwise thinking will only achieve what is correct, but not what is true. Let us now pause at the place we have reached thus far, to which we have risen via amazement, reverence, and wisdom-filled harmony with the world's phenomena, arriving at what we have described as acquiescence, which we have not yet explained, but about which we shall continue to speak tomorrow. Let us retain our hold on acquiescence, but let us also retain our hold on the question already raised. Why is it necessary to be merely intellectual in order to refute spiritual science? We shall proceed with these two questions tomorrow. The end of Lecture 1.